Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So that's our Saturday evening community sit, time to gather together and the opportunity to reflect on Dhamma. And this was set up by the Buddha, really encouraged people who were practicing, his monks and nuns, even those who lived with just a couple, just a few, to meet at least once a week, if not more, to reflect on the Dhamma. There's so many different aspects of the Buddha's teachings that one could reflect upon. But for myself, in my own practice, I tend to just see what's present in my own mind, in my own stream of being, rather than try to, you know, methodically move through the teachings to reflect on Dhamma for myself. I just see what's present, see what's arising, and quite often the mind, I guess having been a practitioner for many years, will just begin to reflect quite naturally in relation to what's present. And of course, this, in one sense, this is the whole of the Buddha's Dhamma. He actually taught specifically and quite distinctly different to many of the teachers in his days. He taught what can be seen for each person for themselves. He didn't teach speculative truths. He didn't, or if you could call speculation a truth. He didn't teach Dhamma that you could not verify for yourself, that it was not apparent here and now to be seen for yourselves, because part of his realization was to recognize that the process of awakening is a deeply personal one, ironically. Awakening to the truth of non-self is a completely personal awakening. That one had to see the Dhamma clearly within one's own experience, within one's own mind, within one's own practice, for it to be a liberating cause, for it to liberate one, for it to change one's view, to bring one into full awakening. Because any belief in speculation or belief in a teaching, Dhamma was used to describe many teachings in the Buddha's day. There was so-and-so's Dhamma and someone else's Dhamma, and this was the Buddha Dhamma. If we cannot awaken based on belief, we cannot awaken based on a speculation. And he went so far as to say, if you actually if you are actually attached or holding on to a speculative view about anything to do with this body, mind, the self, or the universe, or the cosmos, that will actually block your awakening. Quite a profound thing, really, to point out. And so his way of teaching Dhamma was to point people to what they can see for themselves here and now, what they can verify for themselves here and now. And that's perhaps one reason why he begins with the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, with the teaching of suffering, because we can all verify suffering in our lives. And not, we don't have to believe in that experience. We don't have to take it on faith, and we don't have to speculate about it. We can actually apprehend the experience of suffering or dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, stress, pain, mental or physical, from the minutest form of it to the most extreme form of it. It's a common experience among beings. So he starts there, and he actually, you know, he declared on the when he was enlightened, it was because he'd fully understood these Four Noble Truths in all their aspects, 12 aspects of these Four Noble Truths. So what turns this experience of suffering into a noble truth, something that's liberating? I mean, these four truths are connected and only really make sense in relation to each other. But he did say that to see one of these truths clearly, you know, penetratingly, one will see all the others, see the other three, and will comprehend and understand all of them, which is another profound thing to say. But the understanding of these four truths is what was the definitive insight which brought him to full awakening. And it's a shame that these Four Noble Truths, I think they become a bit of a pat kind of teaching, and they become exactly what the Buddha didn't intend. They become a kind of a philosophy, and can get taught in schools these days about Buddhism, the truth of suffering, life is suffering. Unfortunately, it gets taught. It's not that life is suffering, it's that there is suffering, that there is this experience of suffering in this incarnation, in this birth, and that this is undeniable for each person when they come to reflect on it. But he also said, in this fathom-long body, together with mind and perception, is suffering, is also the arising of suffering, or the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path leading to the cessation of suffering. This is within this body-mind, this fathom-long body, together with mind and perception. So this is profound again in itself, because not only we know once we get it gets pointed out, yes, we experience suffering in this body-mind, but he's also pointing out the fact that liberation is here and now, the deathless is here and now, the cessation of suffering is also present in this body and mind. Now that's pretty radical even for a lot of Theravadins these days, to have that pointed out. The Buddha pointed that out. The deathless is present in each of us. The cessation of suffering can be known within each of us. The path of cultivation, the path of practice which leads to its full realization, lay within this body, this fathom-long body, together with mind and perception. So where are we seeking our liberation? Don't we catch ourselves seeking it somewhere other than here, somewhere other than within this experience of body-mind? And this is the force of ignorance, really, where the force of karma, craving and ignorance propels this craving, tendency of craving and seeking to move into the future, that quality of becoming, which takes us into experience of futurizing, and we conceptualize liberation off somewhere else, or the possibility of awakening either somewhere else, or when I become something different or become something other than what is here and now. But if we really reflect deeply on these Four Noble Truths the way the Buddha taught them, he's actually saying your liberation is possible here and now. The deathless reality is here and now to be seen. Why we don't see it is merely that our view is somewhat obstructed. Our mind is not yet fully clarified. We are caught in the habits of this, mostly thinking mind, but also the different habits that we develop, whether in this life or whether you want to think in more than one life, and the power of greed, hatred, delusion that does keep us seeking and does keep us bound up in the experience of what's called the five hindrances, the experience of desire, sense desire that, you know, is usually coming upon conceiving how I can get some pleasure elsewhere, which is often coming on trying to get away from an unpleasant feeling. So we have this desire and aversion which moves the mind. We have habitual tendency to fall into dullness or restlessness or doubt. And these experiences, as we buy into them, as we invest energy into them, continue to kind of kick up the dust. You know, it just keeps, we kind of somehow think we may be, getting somewhere following these habitual tendencies, but we often just kick up the dust and it perpetuates itself. So first we have to really arrest that, you know, come to recognize that becoming energy or the seeking energy or the desire energy that propels us off into a conceptual future. The energy of desire aversion in relation to pain or pleasure that may be present in this body mind. Just recognizing those things through mindfulness, present moment awareness. Not to condemn them, not to believe that they're a me and mine even, but just to see them as the energy of this the energy that the mind is bringing to the moment, really, whether we call it habitual, whether we call it driven by ignorance or craving or clinging. We don't even have to do that. We just have to recognize what's present. But we do have to, having recognized what's present, and this was part of the meditation instruction, to explore, this is in the territory of the second and third noble truth, to explore what it is to let an experience of dukkha or unsatisfactoriness, whether it's physical or mental, once it's arisen in the mind, once we're perceiving it, experiencing it, before we go into, or recognize if we're going into conceiving it as a me and a mine, and then the pain increases because it becomes me and a my problem, and we become someone who is isolated and delimited by that attachment. But even before the conceiving of it as self, there can be this other reactivity to it, trying to get away from something, to usually the painful, unpleasant aspect of mental or physical experience. Our habitual movement is to conceive of something better, to try and get away from it in some form, whether it's shutting down, going to sleep, judging, ignoring, blaming, seeking pleasure elsewhere. that, you know, there's many kinds of strategies, but if we, our work in cultivation, in practice, is to just see things as they are. You know, if we see them playing out as they are, this gives awareness and mindfulness and wisdom the ability to grow stronger. This is the direct witnessing. This is what the Buddha's pointing out. He wants you to witness the cause of suffering when it's there, recognize it. Now witness what's keeping it in being, what's maintaining it in being, because that cause is present in this body, mind, here and now. That's the second noble truth. If we keep witnessing, but with the intention to see what's underneath this, what's keeping it in being, maintaining its experience. And so we have to explore, you know, through experiment. If our wisdom, if our clarity, if our samadhi and concentration and clarity is sharp enough, it might cut through right there and see things very clearly. If they're not yet sharp enough, we either strengthen the samadhi even more by trying to deepen the stillness, or we exercise the investigative mind and turn it to recognizing the causes. The cause, what's present, what's the cause of this experience in this moment? And the cause is not a cause from the past. We're not searching for something, you know, that someone said in the past or did in the past. The cause is always present here and now. And the Buddha gives us a major clue. He says the cause of suffering is craving and clinging. So we just have to begin to understand what is the manifestation of that craving and clinging here and now in relation to this experience of pleasure or pain. So this is our territory of exploration. And to stay with that process, we can also recognize the third noble truth, when sometimes we can see quite clearly if something, sometimes we can be, you know, with our practice and just witness the arising and ceasing of, you know, sensations or thoughts coming and going or sounds. If we pay attention to the ceasing mode, this is in the territory of the third noble truth. Not only of the ceasing of phenomena, but the ceasing of our grasping or clinging in relationship to it, or of conceiving ourselves in relationship to that. So, working with where you're at and where your own interest is in practice, and how much presence of mind there is, how much stillness there is, how much curiosity there is, it's up to you how you investigate and how you explore the experience of these. This is the territory of the five khandhas. This is where we experience form, feeling, perception, mental formations and sense consciousness. And it is the very clinging, craving and clinging in relation to these things that is the cause of suffering. And once the mind sees clearly that very truth, it can automatically release itself from identification with that, the craving and clinging in relationship to that. And that's the experience of cessation of suffering, the third noble truth. Now, if that hasn't yet come through a direct insight, we explore the experience of things fading away, of things ceasing in our own practice, whether it's anything to do with these five khandhas, the sensations, the sense experience, the thoughts, the thought formations, perception, feeling, tone. The Buddha encourages us to explore this pattern of arising, ceasing, of the causes and what brings things or allows things to come to cessation. And in fact, when left alone, things come to cessation by themselves, in fact. And he wants us to see that as well. You know? This is the truth of anicca that he's pointing out. to see the truth of the transient, changeable nature in this experience of body-mind in relation to the khandhas, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, or mental constructs, constructing activities of the mind, conceptual activities of the mind, and through the experience of sense contact. So to recognize anicca is to recognize a truth that is already existent in those things. We don't want to overlay an idea of anicca, but we have to prime our mind, in a sense, just, you know, the Buddha's teaching, to recognize it, something that we haven't recognized before. He's saying, can you recognize this? You know, just that I might point out something in this room that someone hasn't recognized before. It's always been here, but you just haven't brought your attention to it to cognize it, whatever that might be. But once you recognize it, then you can recognize the qualities of it. So it's the same with anicca. We're not trying to turn things into anicca, transient. We just want to see the natural characteristic that these things are in a process of change, that nothing we experience is actually static or solid in that sense, that it's actually a process of conditioned change, and it's unstable because of that. Things are unstable. You can't keep things the same way. Even something that seems pretty solid or permanent, like this gong, which I often use as an example, you know, even that has a lifespan, even that is quite unstable, even though it looks and appears stable and solid to my senses. You know, if we look under the microscope, then we all know it's in a process of disintegration, as everything is. The sun that keeps this universe alive is in a process of disintegration, something as huge as that, let alone the feelings that come and go, the sensations that are constantly coming and going, the thoughts that are constantly coming and going, the mind that is constructing the future, the past, those mental constructions of the mind, how they're, you know, constantly being built and falling apart, being built and falling apart. Sense impressions, how solid are they? You know, can we hang on to sense impressions? Now here, now gone. So the Buddha's just bringing our attention to witness this quality of anicca in the experience of the five khandhas, in relationship to this body-mind, the experience of this body-mind. But five khandhas, it's also external form. Anything related to that. So it's with, he starts, you know, points out these characteristics by starting with anicca before he gets to the characteristic of dukkha. You know, it's because these things are unstable, transient, so you can't actually keep a hold of them. They're a process of change. They're actually not a thing in themselves. Conditioned processes. It's because of that that they're dukkha. They can't bring satisfaction. You know, because amongst all of those changing processes, there's pleasant feeling, mental pleasant feeling and physical pleasant feeling. So we're not saying that everything is painful or that life is suffering, but that we can't even hang on to these pleasant physical feelings or pleasant mental feelings as much as we'd like to. They're also in a process of change. So ultimately this is why they're dukkha. You can't hang on to them, you can't hang on to pleasure. It's impossible. Pleasure is part of a spectrum of this movement between pleasure and pain. So, and pointing out anicca and dukkha to be witnessed as characteristics leads him to talking about the quality of anatta, saying, well, if something is impermanent, it's inherently not going to satisfy you. Why on earth do we claim it to be me, mine, and what I am, when we can actually see it's in a process of change, of disintegrating, it's unstable, it doesn't bring lasting happiness? What he challenges is this ignorance in the mind that actually claims such things to be me and mine and what I am. Because when you do that, when we do that, that is at the root of the cause of suffering in our lives. This conceiving, not seeing something clearly, we conceive it to be me, mine, what I am. And then as it continues to disintegrate and change and be unsatisfactory, we suffer. We've identified with something that's inherently unstable and unsatisfying. So this is his intention in giving these teachings, in pointing our mind, our contemplative mind, which has found some degree of stillness and also has the interest and curiosity to witness this experience. When he points out these things, we have that opportunity, well, we have the, what can happen quite naturally is the letting go. When you see things can't really be claimed as a permanent me and mine, what I am in an unchanging sense. It's not denying the personal experience of change, but he's challenging the tendency to solidify into a solid self. When you can wake up to that, the mind lets go. With the mind letting go of identification with these things is synonymous with the experience of nibbana, with the experience of release, the letting go of craving, attachment. So this has to be known for oneself. It cannot be believed in. It may inspire one, it might encourage one to practice, but it's something that needs to be seen for oneself. But the Buddha pointed out, as I was saying earlier, quite clearly that this activity is present within one to be seen. We just have to bring enough clarity and stillness of mind and point it in the right direction to witness that. So the path as the fourth noble truth being present within one, there's all these faculties that we have, the human faculties we have, what he calls the spiritual faculties of saddha, virya, sati, samadhi, panya. That's confidence or conviction or faith. You can use any of those words. Is saddha, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, stillness, and panya, wisdom. These are faculties that we have and faculties that can be developed. And these five in particular are made much of, called the spiritual faculties and the spiritual powers. If we hone these, if we bring them into balance, if we develop them, the Buddha talked of himself as having developed these and maintained these as being a major cause for his awakening, bringing these particular spiritual faculties into being. And the path talked about as the Eightfold Noble Path is here, is present, using these very faculties. Wisdom relates to right view, right intention. These are wisdom faculties. The Sila faculties, or the sila aspect of the path, is just you know, we can talk about that in many ways, but when the Buddha's talking to practitioners developing meditation, particularly to those who've had some insight into his Dhamma, he talks about it in terms of refraining from, you know, just refraining from unwholesome speech or unwholesome action or unwholesome livelihood. And it's just that act of restraint in itself which fulfills the sila factor. So in this moment when we're meditating, we're already quite restrained in speech, in action, in livelihood. The sila factor is right there. And effort, mindfulness, samadhi or stillness, as we learn to relax this body-mind, but also to bring forth this quality of awareness, which is, as I was saying earlier, is present in the mind, a natural quality of the mind, making that something, bringing that to the fore. This is your refuge in Buddha, or refuge in knowing, where in mindfulness, sampajanya and panya, that's mindfulness, full awareness, and panya develop. Through seeing things just as they are in your own experience. So the Buddha offers these paradigms for us to reflect. He's not asking us to know something that is impossible to know. He's asking us to know these experiences which are already happening within us. But I think one of the most important aspects, at least it has been in my practice path, is to recognize this third noble truth, or the territory of the third noble truth, that in the ceasing of things, the Buddha said, with the ceasing of things there is peace. So going, you know, recognizing we're very much aware of things when they're fully manifest. It takes a little effort to recognize things in their arising mode or before, recognize the space before things arise. But to follow something through to its cessation and stay with the peace of that, to see the peace of that in one's own heart, in one's own mind. And to recognize what remains, to recognize that which is still present. Because this is pointing to that difficult to know deathless element. But it is an aspect of your being, if you like. It can be known. And if you find yourself seeking for it outside of this moment, outside of this very experience, then catch yourself, because you're barking up the wrong tree. But this is a very habitual tendency to seek freedom outside of this moment, outside of this experience. So I'm going to just leave you with one of my favorite teachings of the Buddha, and I've spoken it before here once, but it just comes to mind now, a succinct encapsulation from the Anguttara Tens in response to, I believe, someone who asked about where do things come from. So he says, arising, no, we start with rooted in desire are all things. Born of attention are all things. Arising on sense contact are all things. Converging on feeling are all things. Headed by concentration are all things. Dominated by mindfulness are all things. Surmounted by wisdom are all things. Yielding deliverance as essence are all things. Merging in the deathless are all things. Terminating in Nibbana are all things. So this is a particularly profound teaching which is worth reflecting on again and again. So I'll leave you with those thoughts tonight. Handamayam dhamma gita sadhu kandadama sehi.